Hello, everyone. My name is Kevin England, and this is the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. May 7th, 2010, the second episode for BK Corner. Thanks for joining us. This week, I'll bring you a couple of the follow-ups from last week's episode, a how-to on package installation, and for the lead feature, I'd like to spend some time sharing some thoughts about the life cycle of bees. First off, though, let's start with our normal opening feature, the local hive report. As reported in last episode, no bees for us this time around, but we expect to get some deliveries next weekend. That doesn't mean there isn't things to do in preparation for that. Sharon was out actually mowing the grass this week. Our neighbor is preparing property to plant some corn alongside where we keep our bees, and she looked out there and saw the farmer out there, and she had the opportunity to have a discussion with him. Actually, it's the neighbor hired a farmer to come in and plant some corn in order to get farmland preservation. The person who's planting the crops is someone we know. They used to live locally in the area and happened to be a landscaper that we know. She had a conversation with him telling him that we're going to install packages of bees in a week or so, and just wanted to keep an open dialogue about anything he was going to be due to treating the field. He had told us earlier in the year that he was planning to put some Roundup in there to kill off any vegetation before he started planting the crops. Last year, they came through about June-July timeframe, which was really unfortunate for us because we had our bees out there and they had access to this field, which had grown up with natural scrub, and they plowed it all under, hauled away all the debris, and then disked it. And I think it may have had something to do with how our bees just didn't do as well last year, but whatever the case may be, this year they're going to be planting corn out there, and we just want to know what they're doing from treatment standpoints to make sure we cover our bees. As I said, the farmer is, by trade, a landscaper, has a pesticide license, and he actually told Sharon he walked over and looked at the hive and wanted to see if there were any bees in it and was happy to have the conversation with us so he can keep us posted on it. So good to know that he's aware of it. If you have that going on in your area where people are planting crops or doing pesticides, you know, in the springtime, a lot of people right now, the grass is growing through their patio and they're putting evil stuff out there. Just kind of know what's going on and keep track of your bees. We have a contractor come in and spray our property sometimes. Ehrlich is a pest control company here in the Northeast, and we talk to them too and let them know, you know, when you're coming out and you're doing treatments for carpenter bees and anything like that that you find on the property, please talk to us first. Make sure we know what's going on so that anything you're going to do is not going to impact our honeybees or the neighbor's bees. We know someone nearby has a couple hives, so always got to keep that kind of stuff in mind. Mowed the grass out there, looked at the yard, everything looks good. We're going to set the boxes out. Right now what we have out there is dug a hole and planted a bunch of cinder blocks to make kind of a platform for the hives to sit on. It raises them up a little bit, makes them a little easier to work with. We had all our hives clustered in one area, and we were talking about prior to setting up our new hives, if maybe we're going to split them, we're going to have two hives to start. I'm really thinking about taking one of them and moving them further up the property line in order to separate them. My thought or concern is about how the bees are coming back to each hive. And I think that they're coming interchangeably through the hives. Originally, somebody had told me that they'd know the pheromone, they know which hive is theirs, and they would go in. But I think they're wandering or migrating between the hives, and I'm wondering if separating the two just seems like a better approach. So whatever the case may be, it's time this week for us to get out there, get the boxes set up, make sure all the equipment's ready, put the smoker in, and just basically get everything ready in anticipation for the bee arrival. So looking forward to that, looking forward to getting some bees on the property again and getting things started here for the 2010 season. Going to take a quick break, going to come back and clarify a couple things said from last week, and then we'll get into this week's feature. Another day, another dollar, makes you wonder where your money went. You can't scream. Can holler in me.
and grab you some of these puppies. When you start looking through the hive, okay, use these babies, okay? And you know what? The bees don't sting through them. And what you do is you put them on and then put your shirt cuff around and put the button on so that the bees don't go in there and sting you on the wrist.
The short segment you just heard was Charlie Isley Jr. talking about donning some nitrile gloves while performing your routine inspections. Last week, I touched upon that and the aspect of wearing safety glasses. And when I listened back to it, well, it made it sound a bit like I'm not too concerned about the use of safety gear. Actually, the opposite is probably true. And like the goofy guy who's standing there on a Saturday morning TV show wearing glasses while he's spackling or something like that, I am that person who often wear just plain old safety glasses when working around the garage or puttering, doing things that most people wouldn't consider doing that. I typically wear eyeglasses as it is and a veil when working with the bees, so there's not much chance of me sticking my fingers in my eyes. But given that one often starts from some assembly area, in my case when working with the bees it's in the garage, and one will probably make their way back to that area to finish up, it makes sense to have safety glasses handy and, more importantly, to use them, especially when chemicals are in the mix. In the follow-on to the opening soundbite for this segment, Charlie Isley went on to talk about the hygiene of wearing gloves and even collecting bird comb that is scraped off and not depositing it around where you keep your bees. Safety and hygiene are both pretty relevant topics when keeping bees, and it seems that things just go better when you're prepared to manage whatever you're digging into. I'm a fan of the thought of using nitrile gloves in some ways and very much not a fan in others. I really dislike the feeling of being stung on the hands, and especially the fingers. I work with computers, and it is really distracting and uncomfortable to try and type with your fingers swollen from a bee sting. You get that painful, burning, itching phase when the swelling sets in, and I just don't like to go through that. I don't know anybody that does, quite frankly. I also dislike trying to work in a hive with leather or canvas gloves. It's awkward, it slows down the pace of what you're trying to do in the hives, and I recognize that you're supposed to be slow and methodical so as not to disturb the bees when you're in there. You are, in my estimation, though, not supposed to be in there for a long time. It's not good for the bees. My father used to say about telephone calls, state your business and get off. It's the same way with working with bees. You got to do your business and get out. I read somewhere recently about the impact of going into a hive and the fact that it slows a hive down by about a day or so. I can't seem to put my finger on the source of that, but I do recall that being a notion that people said the more you're in your hives, the more impact it has to them. Bees will sting the gloves, and the scent is there, and it makes more bees come back to them. You also get them dirty. You have to wash them to keep them hygienic. They're not terrible, but they can be stung through, and the tactile feel when working with the frames certainly leaves a lot to be desired. Going back to the nitrile gloves, if it is true that you can't be stung through them, and it is true that they're more durable and won't break, then maybe they're a better match to what I want from gloves when going in the hives. I said that there is one part that makes me not a fan, and I need to address that. I bought several ceramic mugs to work to drink coffee from. I just can't bring myself to use paper or worse, styrofoam cups every time I want a cup of coffee. I feel the same way about the plastic water bottles. So the notion of using a glove and discarding it just doesn't sit well with me. Eventually they're going to end up in a landfill and they're not going away for a long time. To use them as a single use, I just can't fathom it. That goes in direct contrast to use them for one hive and discard them so you don't cross-contaminate. I suppose I'm going to try the common sense method here. If the bees are plenty in the hive, meaning there's lots of them, then typically they take care of themselves and keep everything in order as far as health-wise. If things seem healthy in the hives, then I'm going to reuse them between hives. If there's something going on in one of the hives, then certainly I could find use to the one hive. The onus on me to recognize that something is going on there, and I need to make sure that I'm not cross-contaminating, but I'm going to take my chances. If over the season, though, I find that they're not really durable, that the bees can sting freely through them, and the benefits are not worthwhile, then I'll go back to my canvas gloves or bare hands. I said before that I have big hands, and I just have this sense that they're going to break all the time when in use, but time will tell. You know, wearing gloves is one aspect of hygiene, and Charlie's comments about cross-contamination of hives wasn't something that I had given much thought of. I'm sure it crossed my consciousness, but I didn't specifically go through some sort of routine to find a way not to cross-contaminate. I, or we, as Sharon often gets out to assist me, tend to be more concerned about keeping things in order when working with the bees. Somewhere along the line, we came across a small plastic wheelbarrow-type yard cart. I like to move from hive to hive and have what I need handy and organized. We typically load up the cart to be a mobile beekeeping kit. There's a small tray that holds the hive tools, and we keep pine needles in a recycled Maxwell House container for the fuel that we use for the smoker. I load the smoker in there, a grill lighter, a bee brush, and a few other miscellaneous tools. Maybe on one of the upcoming episodes I'll go over an inventory of the tools in our arsenal as part of a feature. The point I'm laboring to get to is that in my mind a related aspect of hygiene is keeping everything organized and keeping your tools in order when working in the hives. Okay, time to switch gears. I mentioned in the previous episode that we have bees on order. While I know that a lot of people lost bees last year, it nags at me that I haven't fully taken the time to understand what went wrong in our case. I have my suspicions, but I really need to know. I started doing research for what really happened in our case, and in the next segment I want to share with you what conclusions I've come up with so far and an aha revelation I've had along the way.
So hard to fathom that we have come this far this way. We didn't know the price we would pay.
Welcome back to the Beekeeper's Corner. I wanted to talk about the aspect of the life cycle of bees and some things that I've learned. This past week, I started going back through the older bee culture magazines that I have, some articles I've collected, and I've done some poking around on the internet. To recap our situation, we had three hives at the end of the season last year, and by the end of the season, I mean August-September timeframe, and they were in varying states. The first hive of the three, the one that we had the longest, looked great. The other two, not so much. I'm not so concerned about the two weak hives. I could say that the low bee counts from a poor start, wet spring, and not so productive summer led to the simple fact that they were not equipped to make it through winter. We did dust those two hives with powdered sugar and kept the varroa mites down, but they just didn't have the numbers even after we confined them to overwinter. My focus and desire was to know what happened to the anchor hive, the one we started with in 2008. Our notes from a late inspection in August indicated that there was reasonable brood patterns in the anchor hive and quite a bit of honey stored, along with sufficient frames of pollen. have to quantify the brood comment. I envisioned at the time of those inspections that brood rearing would fall off some, as there would be less onus on the bees to make bees when they're trying to cull their numbers to get through fall and winter. I didn't see a lack of tons of brood in the brood chamber as a problem. As I mentioned before, the anchor hive was wiped out and beeless in mid to late September. Moving into the research, I heard reports in passing about bees just leaving hives in the late summer, but never saw anything formal on that. Tim Schuler, the New Jersey State apiarist, had a notation in the March newsletter report that there were colonies that died over the winter with no dead bees found in the colony afterwards. I'd hate to jump to conclusions and lump our situation in that and say that's the answer, but there is an aspect of our hive going south that puzzles me, and that there was no evidence of a colony in place when we opened the hive in mid-September. The wasps, the yellow jackets, and the honeybees were in there raiding, but the bees did not appear to be living in there from what I saw. So now to the aha moment that makes more sense to me. I found an article in an issue of Bee Culture magazine that talks about queenwright hives. Queenwright was something I touched upon in the first episode. The article provides insight on how to check if your hive is queenwright and provides some telltale signs of where a queen is failing. One of the observations one can make is that brood cells are not flat with the comb but domed. I saw that in our August inspection and made a note of it. I didn't know what it meant at the time, but I specifically remember discussing with Sharon the topic and trying to surmise what it was. It turns out that when a queen is failing, she will lay some drone brood in a regular worker bee comb. Drone brood, of course, is larger than worker nurse bees, and being a novice, it was not something that tipped us off to problems. I suspected all along that the queen was failing, and that it had something to do with why the hive didn't make it, and now I have some evidence that points in that direction. The sad thing is that as novices, we had to learn that lesson the hard way. I am full disclosure about things, and I'll share another misnomer of how I thought this worked. I always assumed that in nature, if a queen was not well and at the end of her usefulness, then the hive would replace her. I don't understand yet why this wouldn't happen since we didn't intervene. I know after reading that some beekeepers seem to infer that we have to watch for a failing queen and order a new replacement. I'm going to have to start to ask more about this cycle and get in tune with the failing queen phase for the next set of hives. Perhaps I'll suggest, after coming to some of these realizations, that our Beekeepers Association spend some time educating on this aspect for hobby beekeepers amongst us. While looking for answers, I followed down another thread about the aspect of winter bees. The notion of a different class of bees was something that I wasn't aware of and piqued my interest. I wondered if maybe we did something wrong in the aspect of hive management, and what I discovered was interesting. Again, full disclosure. I didn't take the Rutgers class that Sharon did, so maybe without that background I'm a bit disadvantaged, but I assume that nature and bee rearing took care of ensuring honeybees were equipped to overwinter. They do survive in nature, after all. I didn't give much thought about how it happened, and quite frankly never knew that something winter happens in hives so that they can make it through the winter periods. Again, back to some evidence found in Tim Schuler's March apiarist report. Tim shared that the evidence seemed to show that varroa mites had an impact on hives that he inspected and their ability to overwinter. Improper varroa control led to bees that were not equipped to survive the winter we had here in New Jersey. Tim stated in the newsletter, and I quote, "One mite in a pupal cell will decrease the lifespan of that worker bee 20-40%. That worker will not be able to properly feed the next generation of baby bees." He goes on to say that summer bees are short-lived, that they have a six-week lifespan, and he contrasts that with the description of winter bees, which he described as long-lived. Winter bees have an additional fat in their body that allows them to live 4 or 5 months. It stands to reason, then, that the critical period for beekeepers is that period where a hive starts to change over and starts to raise bees in preparation for overwinter. In New Jersey, that appears to be August-September timeframes, the same times that we had our challenges last year. Well, I thought we did a good job at varroa control. I know this year that I'll be extra diligent in keeping varroa in check. We dusted the bees weekly with powdered sugar and inspected for mites on checkboards, but this year I'm going to follow a formal program for counting the mites and using chemicals if need be. We try to practice integrated pest management, which means no chemicals, but if it's down to the survival of the bees, we'll do what's necessary. Incidentally, I shouldn't take for granted that everybody understands what I'm talking about for dusting bees. One of the things you do instead of using a chemical is you dust the bees with powdered sugar. The powdered sugar melts on the bees because they keep it warm inside the hive, and that provides a slippery surface which the mites can't hang on to, and the mites fall through and land on the bottom board. Hopefully you either have a tack board down there to pull the mites out or a screen bottom boards where they fall through. If you're using a solid bottom board, the bees that are coming and going walk across the solid bottom board, pick up the mites later, and the mite problem continues. So that's a little bit about that in case you hadn't heard for this. It's been about 2 weeks or so since our Beekeepers Association installed a package of bees in one of the club's hives. I brought my 10-year-old along to see the installation and shot some video with my cell phone while helping him understand what was going on. I let him know on the drive over what would happen and then gave him some insight as the package installation went along. I thought it would be interesting to pass along a high-level process for those who have never seen the method of installation, and at the end here I'll share a link that you could watch the video. They started out with a single box and pulling 5 or 6 frames out of the hive box that the package was going to get installed in. They put an entrance guard on it in preparation for the installation, and they sprayed the package of bees with a sugar water syrup. The package of bees looks about the size of, say, a Raisin Bran box or a Cheerios box, but double thickness. It's a wooden frame around the outside with mesh on both sides, and actually, these things come packaged and shipped through the mail. A lot of mail people don't like to deal with them, but you could also get them from beekeepers who sell beekeeping supplies. They ship them up from Georgia or wherever they're going to get bees from. When you spray them with sugar water syrup, the purpose of that is just to get their wings wet so they don't fly away, or at least that's what we've been told. It also might get a little sugar coating on the bees, and they'll get their attention focused on cleaning each other off. You don't want to soak them, you just want to wet their wings. And especially on a cold day, you don't want to soak them, because if you get them too wet, they'll get too cold, and they're not going to survive that way. The way the package comes, it comes with a can that sits in the top and a cover over it. You pop the cover off and there's 2 bundles in there. The first one is a small little compartment that holds the queen. You're going to pull that queen out and set her aside in a safe place. You install her last as part of the package installation. Then you're going to pop out the metal can or whatever feeder device that comes with the package, And typically that's filled with sugar water syrup for the bees to eat during the trip to wherever their destination is. As you pull that can out, it's going to leave a hole, and obviously the bees can come airborne. Most of the time you just cover it with a piece of board that came with it. And with a firm motion, and this seems really counterintuitive, but you're going to take that box and you're going to set it aside and you're going to bang it on the ground. And the purpose is you're going to bang all the bees down to dislodge them from the wire and get them all into one cluster in the bottom of the box. Then you turn it over and you literally shake and dump them into the box so that they go down inside the hives. Once you get all the bees mostly there, you're going to take that box sitting with the hole up and put it right in front of the hive. They'll find their way back in later for anybody that didn't come through. And you're going to start setting the frames that were pulled out in the hive in preparation for the queen installation. Once you get all your frames in the box, then it's time to turn your attention to your queen. You're going to take your queen out, and she comes in something about the size of a stick of gum, maybe double the thickness, and it usually has a cork in one end and a candy in the other end with a cover. You pull the cover off, and the general purpose of this is you're going to put the candy end in the hive, and the bees are going to come and eat through the candy and eventually free the queen and allow her to come down into the hive and be introduced. The standard way to do this is to pin some nails in the little matchbox type thing that she came in and set her in the hive between two frames. This year, for the installation that we had, they popped the one cover off and found out that the candy was already gone, and had they just set her down, she could have crawled out and possibly flown away. So what they did was they took the hive, took the box, set it inside the hive, and made sure that they could watch her actually physically go down in the hive. You want to be careful, though. I know that this seems like a way that you could potentially introduce a new queen in. If this queen, which came with the package, didn't come with the package, and you were trying to put her into a box, say, for a split, and you just let her out, they would probably see her as foreign and kill her. So you want to be careful with that and give them time to acclimate. But in this case, she was there, her drones and her attendants were there, and we opened it up, and she went right down in, and it was pretty cool to watch everything get set out. Once the frames kind of filled out and everybody took place, pulled the frames, took a look, found the queen. She had a nice blue dot on her. She was easy to find, and it will take a few days for the hive to become acclimated. It's probably best to cover them up, let the package settle in, let her start laying brood, and sooner or later you're going to have a working hive. As I said before, I made a video of this, and it's on our Beekeepers Association website, which I provided links from episode 1, or you can pick up the video and watch it on our website, which is www.bkcorner.org. That's going to do it for this episode of the Beekeepers Corner. Next week, we're expecting to pick up our bees, and we'll let you know how it all works out. The following week, I plan to run down to Medford, New Jersey, and the New Jersey Beekeepers Association spring meeting. I attended last year and enjoyed the session and the exposure to the beekeeping information at the state level, and expect to get more of the same. Before we close down, I'll remind you that you can contact me at kevin@bkcorner.org or pick up our podcast at www.bkcorner.org. Apologies for the delays in getting this week's episode posted. Had some storms here in New Jersey this past week, and one of them zapped the power supply at my computer on the night that I had production scheduled for this episode. I'll share with you as we close out this week's episode that it featured the music of Bob Mouse and Another Day, Another Dollar, and Leif Williamson with Big Blues on our outro. The opening music is from my favorite band from the Bay Area, Huey Lewis and the News. Thanks everyone for listening.